It's Wednesday, March 27th. The lights were off, but everyone could feel this. We start here. The longest bridge in Baltimore suddenly collapses.
Think about a New York City skyscraper ramming into this bridge.
What was behind this deadly shipping crash, and what could it mean for people across the country?
There'll be a long road as we talk about what does the future of this region, the future of the area look like.
Our team's got all the angles covered. We will take you to the scene. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court asks plaintiffs, what are you doing here?
Did she have an opportunity to object? Did she object?
No, Your Honor. Again, these are life-threatening situations.
What these skeptical justices could mean for the abortion pill. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. You know how, like, in an old movie, when they want to convey just the idea of a disaster, they might play stock footage of terrible catastrophes throughout history? Like trains running into each other, or that famous black and white footage of a bridge warping until it falls apart. These are the kind of historic markers that scream something terrible happened here.
At about 0150 hours, our first unit arrived on scene and reported a complete collapse of the Key Bridge.
Well, early yesterday morning in Baltimore, a huge container ship was in the Patapsco River heading toward the Francis Scott Key Bridge that spans it, and the ship couldn't stop.
Yo! What the f***? What the f***?
You can see it all unfolding on cameras along the shoreline. Something is wrong with this ship's engines, and it's just drifting, slowly, toward one of the columns that's holding this bridge up. When that impact comes, you can see that column buckle. And suddenly, from a distance, this gigantic bridge seems fragile, like it's made of matchsticks. The entire thing collapses into the river, sending up a spray of water as cars, like tiny ants, are trying to race away. This footage seems like something you would see in one of those old film reels, something your grandkids will watch as an example of a structural catastrophe. As of this morning, there appear to be six dead with ramifications that could go beyond this region. Let's take you straight to the scene this morning. ABC's transportation correspondent Gio Benitez is at the crash site. Gio, can you just describe the scale of this?
I mean, Brad, you're talking about a massive, massive ship. It's essentially about 1,000 feet long. So think about a New York City skyscraper ramming into this bridge. And that's what happened here.
Our 911 center dispatched a call to the Baltimore City Fire Department for a report of a water rescue.
It was at 1:30 in the morning when the ship struck that bridge, and it just came crashing down.
213 dispatch, the whole bridge just fell down.
But here's the incredible part. The ship's crew was able to issue a mayday and warn the people on the bridge. They were able to get police officers on site and help manage the traffic, make sure that people didn't get on the bridge, and those that were on, try to get them off.
I need one of you guys on the south side, one of you guys on the north side, hold all traffic on the Key Bridge.
And Brad, you could even hear this in the radio traffic from Broadcastify.
Yeah, if we can stop traffic, just make sure no one's on the bridge right now.
That's really just an incredible tale of heroism that we're witnessing here.
Yeah, Gio, what was so otherworldly about all this was you had all this CCTV footage from around the port, and you could see these trucks and these cars crossing the bridge like minutes before this went down, and you still had construction crews working on this, right? Did those guys make it off?
So officials have said that there were about eight construction workers that they know of on that bridge at the time. Two of them were actually rescued.
We were able to remove two people from the water. One individual refused service and refused transport. Essentially, that person was not injured.
We know that one was treated at a hospital and released, but there are six others who are still missing. What's really tragic about this is that these are frigid, frigid waters where hypothermia could set in.
We do not believe that we're going to find any of these individuals still alive. And so this evening at around 7:30, we are going to suspend the active search and rescue efforts.
And they haven't been able to find them yet.
How did this happen, Gio? I mean, do we know?
So when you look at the video, Brad, you see that the ship had all its lights on And then the lights shut off, almost like a movie. And it's really eerie when you watch this. And it's moving at about 9 miles per hour toward the bridge with the lights off. And then they flicker on again and then off. So clearly there was some sort of loss of power. And that's what officials are looking at right now. And officials held a press conference yesterday.
What they're going to look at and begin to collect is information on vessel operations, safety history, safety record.
The problem is we don't know what caused that loss of power. They lost the propulsion and they lost control of that ship. And that's what the NTSB is going to be focusing on.
Part of our investigation will be how was this bridge constructed? It will look at the structure itself. Should there be any sort of safety improvements?
At this point, they don't think there was anything malicious, and they believe that this was simply an accident, a terrible, terrible accident.
Well, and Gio, I'm looking at a list of the worst bridge collapses we've ever had in this country. Several of them are because of ships, of barges, running into them. I mean, are there broader risks here when it comes to sort of these types of infrastructure coming together?
You know, one of the first things I did when this happened is that I looked at the bridge's infrastructure and the integrity of the bridge, because all of that is public data. And so they were pretty standard repairs that they were working on, the construction workers. But the integrity of this bridge wasn't necessarily in question. The truth is that bridges aren't built to withstand that kind of impact.
Right, especially a direct impact. And actually, to avoid direct impacts like this, sometimes bridges have these things called fenders or dolphins, they sometimes call them, like they're coming up out of the water, these things that kind of redirect things away from the bases of these columns. Engineers we've spoken to at ABC said they didn't see any of these fenders at this location on first glance, unclear if perhaps they could be underwater or if they even would have done anything. But Gio Benitez at the scene, we'll let you get back to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Brad.
Now, this is going to have implications for people far beyond Baltimore. So let's talk more about next steps. ABC's Elizabeth Schulze covers the economy, and she's been following the impact of this bridge collapse. Elizabeth, what happens now?
Right. So, Brad, the first thing we'll need to be clearing the wreckage of the cargo ship. And that's going to be a big undertaking. You could see when we were on location yesterday, the steel jutting out from all around the cargo ship and just the recognition that this will be a big task to rebuild the bridge.
The path to normalcy will not be easy. It will not be quick. It will not be inexpensive.
Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg admitted that this is going to be a big undertaking in that press conference.
The president's plan is to work with everyone here in order to rebuild this bridge and reopen this port, including our readiness as a department to approve emergency funding.
The bridge that collapsed was a heavily trafficked corridor. About 30,000 vehicles crossed back and forth across it every day. Commuters, companies that relied on it for distribution. So they're going to find an alternative route in the meantime. And it's not just the road that needs to be rebuilt. Of course, we're talking about the port also being at a standstill.
Right. Tell me more about the port, because this, like, I've seen the wire. I know this is like a huge shipping center, right? It's a hub. Does this go beyond that one container ship?
This is one of the busiest ports in the U.S., Brad, the ninth busiest. It transports about $80 billion in cargo every year. And just to put that into context, if you look at that on a daily basis, that means $220 million in goods are coming through the Port of Baltimore. And now those goods have nowhere to go because the port is blocked. Mm. We heard from officials all throughout the day saying they don't know how long it will be blocked. They don't know how long it's going to take for ships to be able to come back in and out. So in the meantime, some of those cargo ships that would normally be using the Port of Baltimore, and especially when you think about industries like autos, where this is actually the most heavily trafficked route for auto imports, almost 850,000 cars and light trucks come through that passage every single year. So they're going to have to find somewhere else to go through. And I've been talking to economists on this. They say the expectation is that companies will find alternative paths, that there are enough ports kind of up and down the East Coast that they'll just be able to reroute. And we are already hearing that some auto companies like GM and Ford are planning to do that. That could mean that there are some delays for products. You know, it might mean your local dealer is delayed in getting that shipment by a day or a week. But the big impact isn't expected to be massive, because a lot of those imports that will be coming in through Baltimore will just be going through somewhere else. And that is one of the lessons, actually, Brad, that we did learn from the pandemic, was how to kind of beef up the supply chain so that if one area becomes blocked, are there alternative routes instead? Shipping has undoubtedly become more expensive, so there could be some additional costs here, but they're hoping that they can work through the kinks to figure out how to continue to get products through. This also isn't a traditionally super busy time of year for inventory to be moving around, so that's another silver lining of this. But there's another important note on the economic angle here, Brad, and that is the impact on the local economy. While economists are saying they don't expect the U.S. broadly to be massively impacted by this closure of the port and by the bridge being shut down, there will be an impact on the community of Baltimore. We heard that from local officials like Governor Wes Moore.
There's going to be a long road, not just as we go from search and rescue. There'll be a long road as we talk about what does the future of this region, the future of the area look like.
About 15,000 workers rely on that port for their jobs directly or indirectly. So this does throw them into a state of uncertainty. And for the community, it's a question of how long is it going to take to get things back to usual? That is still a big question mark at this time.
Yeah, is this rebuilding I can't even imagine when you look at this warped steel in the water, how long this will take all to rebuild. All right, Elizabeth Schulze, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Brad.
All right, next up on Start Here, it was billed as the biggest abortion case since Dobbs, but was it over before it began? We're back in a bit.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
As that emergency was unfolding on Chesapeake Bay, over in Washington, D.C., protesters had already started gathering at the Supreme Court in anticipation of perhaps its biggest case of the term.
Women deserve actual health care.
This actually became so heated that there were arrests on scene as the justices indoors considered whether the FDA had overstepped in making chemical abortions so much more available to Americans over the years. At stake are perhaps new restrictions on mifepristone, the drug, but the justices actually didn't spend that much time talking about the drug itself or even the FDA. ABC senior Washington reporter Devin Dwyer was in the courtroom for this hearing. Devin, can you just describe how the justices reacted here?
It was kind of astonishing, Brad. I mean, if you take a step back, this is the first time in 2 years that the Supreme Court was taking up this issue of abortion. And the same court that just a couple years ago rolled back protections for a right to abortion yesterday seemed ready to strike down this challenge that would take away the most popular form of abortion. You had a majority of the justices yesterday, including several of the conservatives, taking real issue with this idea of standing. Brad, we've talked about it before, but whether these doctors, these conservative anti-abortion medical groups bringing this challenge to the pill, even had any right to be in court to begin with.
And this case seems like a prime example of turning what could be a small lawsuit into a nationwide legislative assembly on an FDA rule or any other federal government action.
As you know, in this country, to bring a challenge against a government policy in federal court, you've got to be injured by that policy. You have to be able to prove that you've been directly harmed by it, and that if the court acts to do something about it, that you would be remedied, that you would be fixed and healed by whatever the alleged injury, you know, was.
I think the difficulty here is that, at least to me, these affidavits do read more like the conscience objection is strictly to actually participating in the abortion to end the life of the embryo or fetus. And I don't read either Scott or Francis to say that they ever participated in that.
It was almost an extraordinary display, Brad, to see conservatives like Justice Neil Gorsuch, Amy Coney Barrett, express some real skepticism that this group of seven individual doctors and their associated affiliations really showed in the record here that they had been hurt by the FDA's rollback of regulations around mifepristone in 2016 and 2021 to make it more widely available, and that their conscience, their religious conscience as opponents of abortion, was violated in having to treat women who experience side effects of mifepristone.
I see. Like, a woman has an abortion and, like, comes in seeking treatment or something, and the doctors are like, I've been injured by that. And the court's asking them, how?
Exactly. And there were these affidavits that were sort of lacking on detail in the court record that said certain doctors had had to treat women or be around women who had sort of failed abortions using mifepristone, and that because they were treating them in the ER, they were violating their conscience. But justices like Ketanji Brown Jackson, Sonia Sotomayor, even Neil Gorsuch suggested there are already protections for religious conscience under federal law. Doctors can, of course, object to perform a certain procedure or treat a certain type of patient if it violates their religion.
Did she have an opportunity to object? Did she object?
No, Your Honor. Again, these are life-threatening situations in which the choice for a doctor is either to scrub out and try to find someone else or to treat the woman who's hemorrhaging.
Well, usually conscience objections, the way people with conscience objections do this, is they make those objections known.
And so there was a lot of wonder about why didn't these doctors invoke those protections in this case if they had real concerns. And the attorney representing these plaintiffs, Erin Hawley, the wife of Senator Josh Hawley, the conservative from Missouri, a darling of the conservative right, really struggled to provide specific examples other than to say merely being in the presence of a patient that had struggled with a mifepristone abortion was enough in her view. But she couldn't provide a lot of specifics, Brad.
That's interesting. And you said most of the justices appeared skeptical of this claim in the first place. Does that mean, were there justices that appeared to be sympathetic to the plaintiff's case at all?
Well, Justice Samuel Alito, who, of course, wrote the Dobbs opinion taking away the right to an abortion, was right in the corner of these plaintiffs.
During the questioning of the Solicitor General, the statement was made that no court has ever previously second-guessed the FDA's judgment about access to a drug, right? And it's never second-guessed that.
That's correct.
You think the FDA is infallible?
Suggesting time and again that the FDA is not infallible, that they can be challenged, even by these sort of attenuated impacts on emergency room doctors down the line. Mind you, Brad, the statistical significance of a woman taking mifepristone, suffering a complication, and ending up in the emergency room is extremely small.
Right.
And so the government was arguing that, wait a second here, not only would you have to find a woman somewhere in the country who took the pill, suffered the complication, and ended up in the ER, but also then ended up in front of one of these objecting doctors. Would that scenario really exist statistically? Is there a significant probability that's even a possible harm? Well, Justice Samuel Alito suggested it sure could be, and that was enough for him to be a grounds to possibly roll back and strike down these provisions.
So, I mean, what are the possible outcomes at the end of the day? Because Kate Shaw kind of teed us up for this yesterday, saying there's sort of a wide range, and depending on how far the justices wanted to go, in theory, this could affect every American. But I mean, what's on the menu, I guess?
Well, the bottom line, Brad, is that yesterday it seemed that these conservative challengers didn't even get out of the gate. The court spent very little time debating the merits of what the FDA did in making it easier for women to access abortion by mail, with fewer doctor's visits up to 10 weeks of pregnancy, those looser restrictions. They didn't even really get into that yesterday. And so if this case is tossed out essentially on grounds of standing or lack of standing on the part of these doctors, then the status quo remains. You know, more than 5 million women have used mifepristone. It's the most widely used and method of abortion in this country. And it's become even more popular, according to the Guttmacher Institute, in the wake of that Dobbs decision because it's easy to use. You can cross state lines and get the pill, take the pill, go back to your home state. You can also order it by mail under these regulations. So all of that will stand if the Supreme Court kicks out this challenge to the pill, despite what the lower courts have said. All of that said, conservatives Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito seem to be laying the groundwork yesterday, Brad, for future challenges.
How do you respond to an argument that mailing your product and advertising it would violate the Comstock Act?
Really inviting perhaps states on a different grounds to come in and challenge some of the way that the FDA has been doing things. Justice Clarence Thomas bringing up a piece of 1870 law known as the Comstock Act, rarely invoked in over 100 years, but was passed, still on the books. It bans the mailing of any drugs or equipment that could be used in an abortion. That's still active. And he suggested that maybe courts should go back and take a look at the Comstock Act and apply it to the mailing of the pill. So there are future challenges on the horizon, but the big takeaway 2 years after this same court got rid of the right to an abortion is that they may have stepped back from taking away the most commonly used form of abortion, and that was a huge sigh of relief yesterday for abortion rights advocates outside the Supreme Court, Brad.
Yeah, you could almost see the eyes of the nation on this court wondering, what are you going to do now? Now that you've already taken this huge step, are you going to go even further? Not necessarily, it appears, and yet to hear justices be like, actually, if other people brought these types of cases, we might listen. Really interesting. All right, Devin Dwyer there in Washington. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, where are my Easter peeps at? You could be in for an extra surprise at the grocery store. One last thing is next.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. When I went Easter egg hunting as a kid, I had a very clear hierarchy in my mind of what I was looking for in those little plastic eggs. At the bottom of the list, it was jelly beans. I'm sorry, you guys. They're too sweet. There's too many flavors that just aren't good. It's like a black licorice-flavored lottery. Next was Peeps, something marshmallow adjacent. But what I really wanted was chocolate. Well, hopefully the Easter Bunny has stocked up on some of his chocolate self-portraits because confection makers are now saying chocolate prices are about to hop. The price of cocoa has exploded over the last year. It's now 5 times what it was just a few years ago. And while chocolatiers have largely avoided passing these costs on to consumers, executives from both Hershey and Cadbury say their prices are going up.
So given where cocoa prices are, we will be using every tool in our toolbox, including pricing, as a way to manage the business.
Apparently, torrential rain and bean disease has impacted major cocoa-growing regions, and the timing couldn't be worse. According to the National Confectioners Association, Easter follows Halloween as the second most popular holiday for purchasing candy. Which is a problem if you're one of these candy companies, because during periods of high inflation, the first thing customers stop doing is impulse shopping. They still pay for stuff, but they plan their purchases. Well, name a product that is more reliant on impulse shopping than chocolate. That's why candy bars are by the cash register. You've had a long day, why not treat yourself to a Butterfinger? Holidays like Easter put that into hyperdrive. You've got bins of these things at the front of the store. Well, now, sensing that customers might not pay these higher prices, they're pushing alternatives to customers like white chocolate and more sugar-based treats like, wait for it, jelly beans. Good luck if you gave up chocolate for Lent. It still could be out of reach. Some of you were lucky enough to be hunting for dollar bills when you were a kid. My main thought process there still, though, would be, this is money to be spent on chocolate. Like, that's how obsessive I would get. Lots of updates coming out of Baltimore throughout the day. So more on abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Chocolate.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially 4 trials facing former President Trump as he makes his 3rd bid for the White House. what do voters think about his culpability? And would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.